The U.S. decision to seize half of Afghanistan's frozen assets is prompting an angry outcry from people in the war-torn nation. Hamas is warning Israel of consequences after Israeli troops and settlers attack Palestinians in a flashpoint neighborhood in the occupied Al-Quds. And the Tunisian president issues another decree to increase his judicial powers, raising the already high political tensions in the Arab country. I'm Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with Afghanistan, the central bank there is harshly critical of the U.S. plan to seize half of the $7 billion in frozen Afghan funds it's holding. The bank says Afghanistan will never accept the seizure of its assets in the name of compensation or humanitarian assistance to others. The bank says this is injustice to the Afghans. The decision has sparked outrage in the country that's reeling under immense food insecurity, poverty, and disease. Afghan people have been demonstrating their anger and speaking out against Washington's decision.
I don't think the U.S. has the right to use Afghanistan's money to compensate 9/11 victims. The U.S. had no reason when it attacked us, but a lot of people died in the past 20 years. So it is the U.S. that should compensate us, and they should not spend their money.
Joe Biden the other day decided that Afghanistan's frozen assets would be given to the 9/11 victims. Therefore, we are protesting today, and we are asking the international community, how can Biden decide on the assets of Afghan people to spend it for the 9/11 victims?
Now, Washington says it will free up half of the Afghan funds it holds to compensate the families of 9/11 attacks. The U.S. says it will put the rest in a fund managed by the U.N. for humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan. Washington froze the funds after the Taliban took over power. And that, coupled with U.S. sanctions and a drop in international relief aid, has sent the Afghan economy into a free fall, raising the risk of a humanitarian crisis. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has issued a stern warning after Israeli troops and settlers attacked people in a flashpoint neighborhood in the occupied East Al-Quds. Hamas has blasted the overnight attack on Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood as a flagrant violation. The resistance group says that Tel Aviv is playing with fire and will face consequences for such aggression. Hamas is calling on Palestinians across the entire occupied territories to mobilize in support of the people in Sheikh Jarrah. The neighborhood has been the scene of frequent clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians. Dozens of families living there face possible expulsion from their homes in favor of Israeli settlers. Sudan's de facto ruler is defending intelligence sharing with Tel Aviv, claiming that it has helped protect national and regional security. Army leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan says that the exchange of intelligence with Israel has enabled Sudan to dismantle suspected militant groups. Burhan insists it's legitimate for Sudanese security agencies to have ties with Israel. The top general seized power in a military coup d'etat last October that sparked mass rallies. More than 70 people died in heavy-handed crackdown by the junta. Sudan normalized relations with Israel 2 years ago under a U.S. brokered deal. Ever since, they've forced security and intelligence relations, and their officials have met in unannounced trips. The Tunisian president pushing the limits of his power with an order for creating a temporary council that will oversee the judiciary. Kais Saied's decree gives him almost exclusive power over the justice system after he dissolved the independent Supreme Judicial Council last week. Now, this includes the power to object to the promotion and nomination of judges and to propose judicial reforms. The judiciary was the last branch of power out of Saied's control since it dissolved the government and parliament last year. Now, his opponents say this is a coup. The main opposition party has called a protest later in the day. And when it comes to the war on Yemen, the UAE, that's part of the Saudi-led coalition, is not holding back. While the Yemeni army has started a new retaliatory campaign against the UAE, the Sheikhdom has increased its purchase of military hardware. The next report looks at Abu Dhabi's involvement in the Yemen war and whether the new Yemeni operations will force it to change course.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE, Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support.
Now, when Abu Dhabi is scrambling to boost its air defenses following a string of Yemeni attacks on the UAE's vital infrastructure, it's following in the footsteps of Riyadh and is turning to Western powers like the U.S. to supply with military hardware and weaponry. But reports suggesting that Riyadh is running critically low on ammunition to keep its missile systems operational.
The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung 2 advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? and the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Moving on, Washington throwing the ball into Moscow's court, saying that a path to diplomacy over Ukraine is open, also warning that a response will be tough if Russia moves to invade its western neighbor.
A diplomatic path to resolving this crisis, a crisis created by the unprovoked massing of Russian forces all around Ukraine, that diplomatic path remains open. The way for Moscow to show that it wants to pursue that path is simple. It should de-escalate rather than escalate. If Moscow chooses the path of aggression and further invades Ukraine, the response from the United States and our allies will be swift, it will be united, it will be severe.
Yesterday, we ordered the departure. Blinken says that the risk of Russian incursion is high enough to justify the evacuation of much of the U.S. Embassy staff from Kiev. Moscow has denounced Washington's peak hysteria over Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, that talks of invasion are provocative speculation. Putin warned that this approach can lead to a conflict in Ukraine. He also separately told U.S. President Biden that Washington has failed to give a substantial answer to Russia's security concerns. They include NATO's eastward expansion and its deployment of offensive forces to Ukraine. Well, on that note, political commentator John Bosnich says that Russia has stressed it is not planning on invading Ukraine, and if the U.S. and the West are worried about an invasion, they should provide evidence for such concern.
There's no justification for statements about an attack coming in 1 hour or 3 hours or tomorrow afternoon or anything like that. If this is what the United States and its NATO allies are trying to do, to incite fear in their own populations, then that's what they're achieving. But of that fear, nothing good can come. Russia has been making it very, very clear that they're not planning to invade. If the West is that worried about an invasion, then maybe they should prove the evidence that they're using to make those claims. The people of the region on both sides are all the victims of the current pre-warfare psychological operations. But the far more damaging and unsettling operation is the one being conducted by the United States and its NATO allies, who are goading the war on, who are threatening a war at any moment, and yet saying that they will not intervene in any way. So these elements are definitely stoking the fires of war. And since war is the main business for most of the NATO countries, the military-industrial complex is the main business, then they're just stoking the fires of their own economy at the expense of the Russians and of the Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainians and ethnic Russians in the country of Ukraine.
The hundreds of people in the British capital have taken to the streets to protest the skyrocketing cost of living. The government's recent decision to raise energy prices and taxes threatens to push millions of Britons to choose between heating and eating. Saeed Puriza has sent us this report from London.
Coming out in the cold to make sure everyone gets to keep their home warm in winter amid the soaring cost of living in Britain. The government here blames the skyrocketing cost of living on global energy price hikes. These protesters, however, say it's the big companies that have made windfall profits who should foot the bill not them.
Shell made £14 billion of profit. £14 billion. And BP made £10 billion. Why not take some of that and use that to pay for it?
They need to subsidise those bills. Why not? They've already written off £9 billion on PPE. They've written off £4.9 billion on bad debt, bad COVID loans, bounce back loans. So subsidisers.
The country's energy regulator, Ofgem, has risen the price cap in place to protect the people by more than 50%. The government has introduced a loan scheme to help out, up to $270 per household. But experts say the underlying drivers remain.
There are already a lot of people struggling to keep their homes warm, particularly those who live in houses that are not properly insulated. And the recent price hikes are expected to push as many as a quarter of UK households into fuel poverty.
Rising bills will affect millions, but they'll bite the hardest for those with fewer choices. Add to that a tax rise set to kick in come April.
It doesn't have to be tax, tax, tax all the time. We need to have something to be given to us as well. It's like benefits are not there anymore for us. So you go to work and you're still ending up being in a situation that, oh, where should I go? I can't afford this, I can't afford that. And every year is situation just getting worse and worse.
Someone young and starting off, you know, ready to buy a house and earn a living, it does make me quite worried, especially living in London. Cost of living keeps on rising. Wage is not really reflected in that. So, I mean, I am quite worried about my future and the high cost of living.
Millions of British households will soon face energy bills of more than $2,000 a year. Whether that much can be managed depends on how much you earn and where you live. Saeed Purza, London.
And that's all right for this broadcast.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of the sixth. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, February 13th, 2022. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. If you have any message for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Guess what? I think it's a good time to congratulate you on the World Radio Day. Yes, every year World Radio Day is celebrated on February 13th. The day was decided by UNESCO back in 2011 during its 36th conference. The theme of the 2022 edition of World Radio Day is devoted to radio and trust, because despite a global decline in trust in the internet and social media networks, radio continues to be seen by people as one of the most trustworthy news sources. Yes, we thought it's a good time to congratulate you on this great day. Radio has turned out to be one of the most resilient mediums in the world. Radio has not just survived the coming in of television, but also more technologically advanced audio devices. Radio continues to be seen by people as one of the most trustworthy news sources. So congratulations this great day, and happy this great day to all radio staff, including producers, announcers, journalists, reporters, news writers, as well as radio enthusiasts around the world. So here we are back, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports actually enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us. And here, I do send my appreciations to those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, Arthur Fernandez from Spain, and Rob Boer from the Netherlands. And here, most appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us emails and letters from around the world, including Bathun Rudra from Bangladesh, who has sent us an email. Sutik Hati from India has sent us an email. We have another email from Bangladesh, and this time from Rafi MD Nazmustadat. And from Germany, we have an email from Kurt Ettlinger. And we have another email from India, and this email is from Hemant Kumar. So stay with us. Later during the program, I will read these great emails and letters from around the world. Welcome back. As I said, from Bangladesh, we have an email from Bathun Rudra. So let's see what he says. Hi, my radio friends. How are you? I am Bathun Rudra from Bangladesh. I wish you a happy World Radio Day 2022. I love and will love radio because it is my friend and is the best media all over the world. And I love all radio workers and radio listeners. Salam and warm greetings to you, Bathun Rudra from Bangladesh. And thank you very much for sending us this great message on World Radio Day 2022. Of course, we also congratulate you on this day because you are a radio enthusiast. And happy this great day, World Radio Day 2022, to all radio enthusiasts especially the listeners of IRIB English Radio. Button Rudra from Bangladesh, thank you very much for writing us this congratulatory message on World Radio Day. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. And Dr. Hemant Kumar from India, one of our regular listeners, has sent us an email. And this email, as I see it, is focused on World Radio Day 2020. So let's see what Dr. Hemant Kumar from India says. World Radio Day is an observance day held annually on February 13th. World Radio Day is about celebrating radio. That's why we love it and why we need it today more than ever. A day to remember the unique power of radio to touch lives and bring people together across every corner of the globe. I hope IRIB English Radio makes success. Thank you and good luck. Salam and warm greetings to you, Hemant Kumar from India. And I do send my appreciations to you for sending us such a lovely and great email to IRIB English Radio and the program Listeners Special. Yes, as you said, World Radio Day is celebrated every year on February 13th. World Radio Day is about celebrating radio, and that's why we love it and why we need it today more than ever. As the research shows, radio has become and has turned out to be one of the most resilient mediums and continues to be seen by many people around the world as one of the most trustworthy news sources in the time when we have fake news in the social media and through internet. Thank you very much for writing this email. It was as great as before, Dr. Hemant Kumar, as you gave us great information this time about World Radio Day. Thank you. Write to us soon, Dr. Hemant Kumar from India. And we are waiting for more emails and for more information from you, Dr. Hemant Kumar from India. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. So, after a short break, I will be back with an email from Germany from Kurt Ettlinger. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. As I said, from Germany, we have an email from Kurt Ettlinger. Let's see what he says. Dear sir and madam of the team of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting, as a DXing fan, I scanned my radio dial on Saturday and I found your frequency. I found your programs very interesting and full of information, especially your broadcast lecture. In addition, I hope I would be able to find more secondary frequencies of your station. So I would be very grateful to you if you can send me QSL card for my reception report. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Kurt Ettlinger from Germany in the time of winter, in the cold times of winter. Thank you very much for sending us this email. And it seems that you've just already joined IRIB English Radio listeners, and it's great. We are glad to have you with us. So let this relationship and this mutual relationship continues. So you listen to IRIB English Radio and you write to us, tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs, and we are so happy that you found it interesting and full of information. Kurt Ettlinger from Germany, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card, because sending paper QSL cards is not possible in the time of pandemic. Thank you again, Kurt from Germany. And from Bangladesh, we have another email from one of our regular listeners, from Rafi MD Nazmus Sadat. So let's see what Rafi says. Dear program organizer, happy World Radio Day 2022. We wish everyone a very special greeting on this very day. May radio will unite us all to build a peaceful world. Salam and warm greetings to you, Rafi MD Nazmus Sadat from Bangladesh. And I do send my gratitude to you for sending us this congratulatory message on the World Radio Day 2022. We also wish you the best, and thank you for everything. Why don't you tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast? Yes, in your upcoming emails, tell us which program or programs you like the best. Thank you anyway. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. So after a short break, I will be back with an email from India, from Sutik Hati. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. This email which I'm reading right now is from India. This is from Sutik Hati. Sutik Hati from India says, "Dear IRIB English Radio staff, Happy New Year to all of English service. I have been listening your broadcast since 2009. Your programs are very much informative. For long days, I have not got any letter from you. I hope that you will send me a calendar of 2022 along with your magazines. Salam and warm greetings to you, Sutik Hati from India, and thank you very much for sending us this email. I think this email has been with delay because you've just congratulated the new year to the English service and of course our listeners around the world. Anyway, thank you for that. For your information, we Iranians celebrate the new year on Nowruz, which is the beginning of the spring, and we're just 1 month away to Nowruz and the beginning of spring in Iran. And also we celebrate our new year on the beginning of spring, and it's different with the new year, actually with Christian New Year, which is being celebrated around the world anyway. We also congratulate you on the new year, the Christian New Year 2022. And thank you very much for sending us this email. As for your request for sending you, you know, magazines and promotional items and souvenirs of IRIB English Radio, unfortunately, in the time of pandemic, we can't send you any material. And for the time being, before the coronavirus is eradicated, we will send you an EQSL card, an electronic QSL card, and please accept it from us. Anyway, Sutik Hati from India, thank you very much for sending us this email. We are looking forward to hearing from you. And before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, again, I congratulate you on the World Radio Day. I congratulate all radio enthusiasts and, of course, radio staff on this great day. Please keep in touch with your radio, IRIB English Radio, and have a very good time.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with RIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question regarding the Islamic veil, the covering which is required in Islam for Muslim women, which Muslim women are required to wear. There's a lot of questions that can be asked regarding the Islamic veil, the hijab. A lot of books have been written regarding this topic. It's kind of a hot topic today. Of course, in the past, this was not really a point of contention amongst Muslims. They took it for granted. It was just something that everybody had to do. It was just like nothing. That wasn't really something that could be debated. Even like in a lot of Muslim countries, which have still retained their Islamic ambience and haven't really been affected too much by Western culture or culture of other civilizations, this subject is just taken as a given, and it's not really debated. In any case, the question we want to address today regarding this subject is kind of the philosophy behind it. What's the reasoning behind it? And also, is this something which is kind of contrary to the freedom of women? We can look at this topic from a lot of different points of view, from a jurisprudential point of view, from a philosophical point of view. But in general terms, we can say that from what we can gather from the general feeling that we get from the Islamic texts and the traditions is that this veil, this Islamic covering that's required for women, is meant to protect the personality of the woman. It's meant to preserve it, and it's also meant to prevent corruption. The corruption of young people or even older people in society, and is meant to as a hindrance and a barrier for the spreading of corruption in Islamic society. It's really pretty clear. We see the effects the absence of such a thing in society. Everybody sees it, and we also see the positive effects of it where it's present. And in response to the second question, which was whether or not this is something which is contrary to the freedom of the woman in society, we can say that just like clothes, wearing clothes in general is not really contrary to the freedom of men or women. You know, nobody considers that if somebody comes out, you know, naked and walks around and, you know, on the street and if somebody, the police come and stop him, you know, nobody's going to accept the excuse from him if he says that, hey, you're asking me to put on clothes and this is contrary to my freedom. Right? Nobody's going to accept such a thing. Well, in a similar way, this Islamic veil, this which is a requirement for women, is not something which is contrary to their freedom, neither their spiritual freedom, nor their worldly freedom, their political freedom, their freedom in society. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the Islamic veil and also its connection with the freedom of women. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Britain's oil and gas companies have reported bumper profits as the gas crisis raises the price at which they can sell their fossil fuels without raising the cost of their extraction. While they're being showered with cash, households in the United Kingdom are suffering the biggest fall in income in 3 decades, with 1 in 10 households not having enough money for food and food bank use soaring. We're prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled Facts Give Lie to Claim Record Oil Money is Being Poured into Green Projects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The Chief Financial Officer of Britain's oil and gas company BP, Murray Auchincloss, told investors recently, "It's possible that we're getting more cash than we know what to do with." Oil and gas companies have reported bumper profits as the gas crisis raises the price at which they can sell their fossil fuels without raising the cost of their extraction. While they're being showered with cash, households in Britain are suffering the biggest fall in income in 3 decades. With 1 in 10 households not having enough money for food and food bank use soaring. Recently, BP reported a profit of £9.4 billion for last year, following Shell's recent announcement of $19.3 billion in profits. Little of the money is going to taxpayers. Channel 4 revealed that BP has paid no tax on its North Sea oil and gas for 5 years. Bernard Looney, the chief executive of BP, told analysts he was not seeing increased pressure for the company to pay more tax, despite calls in Britain for a windfall tax on fossil fuel profits to ease the burden of energy bills under vulnerable. Instead, Bernard Looney and other senior managers in the fossil fuel industry have sought to justify their bonanza on the grounds that the billions of extra cash is needed to pour into their transition to low-carbon companies. The facts of oil and gas company investment do not bear out the claim that the massive returns are being poured into green projects and the race to net zero greenhouse gas emissions. Chris Venables of the Green Alliance think tank said, "The time for oil and gas companies to have invested in the clean energy transition was 2 decades ago, when they were peddling climate change denialism. If they were serious about renewable energy, they would be doing it right now, but instead their investments are largely going to new oil and gas, so this is a disingenuous argument." According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, investment in clean energy by oil and gas companies were about 1% of their capital expenditure in 2020, a proportion likely to have reached little more than 4% for the whole of last year. Meanwhile, the companies are continuing to invest vast sums in exploration and new fields, which the International Energy Agency, IEA, said last year could not be brought to fruition if the world was to limit global heating to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. BP plans to invest about £2 billion to £3 billion in renewable energy by 2025, but its overall capital investment will be £60 billion, most of which is likely to go into new production that will raise greenhouse gas emissions. The company is estimated to have spent about $3.2 billion on clean energy since 2016, and $84 billion on oil and gas exploration and development over the same 5-year period. Bernard Looney claimed the vast majority of investment in the United Kingdom would be in the energy transition, but then admitted that this amounted to 40% of its spending budget by 2025, rising to 50% of the budget by the end of the decade. The green spending is likely also to include projects such as blue hydrogen, derived from fossil fuels that critics say produces substantially higher carbon emissions than natural gas. Shell's plans involve an estimated near-term investment of about $2 to $3 billion in low-carbon activities, which is about 10% of its investments, while spending at least $8 billion on upstream fossil fuel production. Richard Black, a senior associate at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank, says, "The key point about oil and gas majors arguing that higher profits are needed to invest in greening their operations is, prove it. If they argue that that is why high profits are justified, they should pledge publicly that a sizable proportion will be invested in proven technologies, like wind power, solar power and storage, rather than blue hydrogen or carbon capture and storage, which are either of unproven potential or several years off." Richard Black was skeptical of whether oil and gas companies would do so. He said, "Past experience suggests that the oil and gas industry is strong on rhetoric when it comes to cleaning up their act, but investment is still inadequate. If they were to make these commitments with a time frame for spending and set up an independent panel of arbiters to verify their commitments, then maybe it would have some credibility." The Labour Party has called for a windfall tax to ease pressure on energy bills, but oil and gas companies have claimed it would discourage them from investing in low-carbon technologies. Green campaigners doubted these claims. Charlie Cronick, a senior climate advisor at Greenpeace, said, "Shell certainly doesn't need the threat of a windfall tax to discourage them from properly investing in renewable energies. They're already failing to do so." Charlie Cronick said, Funding the transition is a convenient excuse to protect their bloated profits. There's no guarantee that any oil company will use the extra cash from this year's bumper profits for the green transition unless they're forced to do so. Yet the British government continues to talk up new production of oil and gas, which will only make the climate emergency worse. According to Connor Schwartz, the climate lead at Friends of the Earth, part of the problem was government failure to shift the balance of economic incentives away from fossil fuels. Connor Schwartz said, "It's clear that oil and gas companies don't intend to divert their eye-watering excessive profits to fund the green transition that we need. They have no profit-based reason to do this, because drilling for oil and gas is more lucrative than investing in cheap green energy." Connor Schwartz added, "This is partly due to government handouts in the form of subsidies and tax breaks, which reward huge multinationals for exacerbating climate breakdown instead of penalizing them." He added, "It's wrong that they're making billions while so many are struggling to eat and heat their homes. People know injustice when they see it. Any government that genuinely wants to help people out of a national crisis would introduce a windfall tax on these profiteering, damaging companies." Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a beautiful tradition narrated from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam regarding the people with whom we should not sit with, meaning the people whom we should not gather with, we should not be in the companionship with. The Imam says, beware of sitting with kings and worldly people. Most kings are worldly people to begin with. The Imam says that, beware of sitting with kings and worldly people. It's possible for the Imam to be referencing worldly kings or even kings who are not so worldly, but nevertheless sitting with them might not be good for us. In continuation, the Imam elucidates why we should not sit with such individuals. The Imam says, for in this there is the erosion of your religion, meaning your religion you will lose your religion, you will become irreligious. Why? The Imam says, and it will bring about hypocrisy in you. Obviously, if you're sitting with a king, you're going to have some purpose for it. You're going to want something for the king. You're going to look at, the things that the king has, his money, his wealth, and you're going to want it. In order to do so, in order to acquire his favor, you might have to lie. You might have to be hypocritical with respect to him, right? So it will bring about hypocrisy in you, and with this hypocrisy, you will lose your religion. The Imam therefore says, and this is a serious disease from which there is no cure. Meaning this disease, hypocrisy, is so bad that sometimes it doesn't have a cure, meaning it remains in you forever, and obviously leads to your eternal damnation. Furthermore, the Imam says, it, meaning sitting with these kings and these worldly people, will also engender hard-heartedness and deprive you of true submission to Allah. Meaning your heart will become hard, you will become very cruel and mean, your heart will harden, it will not become tender. And when this happens, you will not be able to submit to Allah, right? Nothing will affect you, you will not care about submitting to Allah. So we shouldn't sit with such people. We shouldn't sit with worldly people or with kings and wealthy people or men of power, right? So who should we sit with? The Imam elucidates this towards the end of the tradition and says, you must stick to those people who are most like you and the middle classes of people. And most individuals, the Imam is probably speaking to somebody who is of the middle class, a middle class person, an average guy, right? He says, sit with people who are like you, not who are more wealthy than you, who are of a higher social status than you. Right? Sit with people who are similar to you. Why? For it is with them that you will find the true jewels, great talents. Meaning, worldly people and these kings, most of the time, they're not talented, right? Most of them have acquired power by force or through inheritance. They haven't acquired it because they deserved it and they were something inherently and essentially good in them. They deserve it. They had the merits of doing so, right? So, but if you sit with people who are of a middle class, these people are hard workers. They've gotten what they have in life because they deserved it. They used their talents to do so. So you'll find those great talents within these people and you will be able to utilize them. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at who we should sit with and who we should not sit with in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
This part.